state, we legalized abortion in 1970. Here in California, I think it was 68. Yeah. But in 1967, I gave a talk and I said to people, they're trying to legalize the killing of the child in the womb, and we got to stop it. After the masses went down the back and people came up to me, Father, they said, are you okay? Something the matter with you? I said, why? They said, look, there's actually no way that they could legalize it, the killing of a child in the womb. This is America. In 1987, I gave a talk, and I said, you know, we have to change the law and protect all the children in the womb. After Mass, the people came up to me and said, Father, are you okay? And I said, they said, there's no way we could pass a law to protect all the children in the womb. This is America. Yeah. And it hit me, what the Holy Father John Paul II had been speaking about. In America, we went from a culture of life where it was unthinkable that you could legalize the killing of a child in the womb, to a culture of death where it was unthinkable that you could legislate and stop all the killing of the children in the womb. From a culture of life to a culture of death. In the beginning, when the laws were changed, you know, most people became involved in the area of the politics, because we just felt that we could change this, we have to change this. And we didn't. But as the time went on, you know, one of the things that you give to your children, matter of fact, the most valuable thing you give to your children, you give to them before you die. You're in it, the inheritance, not the money. It's not the house, it's not the car, no, it's not. Those things they're meaningless. I know you need that stuff, but that's not important. The most important thing you give to your children, you give to them before they die, you give them life. And then you give them wisdom, how to live life. And finally you give them love. And if a child could say, my parents gave me life, they gave me wisdom, how to live life, and finally they gave me love, you see? You are truly blessed, you see, if you're in that situation. But today, what do we have? We have a society in which it has lost wisdom. It's interesting, you know, there was a leading medical journal here in California that came out in 1970, and in the leading medical journal it said this, life in the womb begins at conception. To say anything else is stupid. We know it's a scientific fact. But there is a problem. Most people yet are not used to killing. We still have it against the law. But it has to be done. It has to be done. To control population, weed out the imperfect, etc., etc., etc. So while you while people still hung up with Judeo-Christian ethics that thou shalt not kill, use any mental gymnastic semantics that you need until people accept killing as a solution. But it said medical doctors should not be so stupid or to claim that we don't know when life begins. Keep saying we don't until it's acceptable to kill. Right? So that's right, 1970. You can look it up. Leading a medical journal for California. President Ronald Reagan quoted that article in the work that he did, that he produced. But now, you see, no semantics, no gymnastics. Because outside the abortion clinics years ago, a person would be arguing with you, how do you know it's human? Or it. Or and whatever you want. That's gone. Now it's, I don't want the baby. What? Yeah, I don't want the child. You're not even arguing about is or isn't it. We have reached that point. We have reached a point where they don't need to use semantics. They don't need to use any type of clouding the issue. Yeah? For those that still need that, we'll tell them that life begins after it has begun and it's over before it has ended. You want to believe that? Well, we do that, don't we? You see? In other words, how long does it take us to do our experimentation? Well, maybe 14 days. Okay, life begins on the 15th day. And people buy that. Eh? And suddenly, when you, a woman's going into an abortion clinic, she's told it's just a blood clot, it's a nothing. It's a blood clot, it's a nothing. What is this blood clot? What is this nothing? Right? What is this nothing? It's a zygote. A zygote. I remember sometimes people use St. Thomas Aquinas and they say, Thomas Aquinas said, we don't know really when life begins, it's quickening, and therefore you maybe shouldn't impose. See? Oh boy, Thomas rolls over in his grave every time people use that argument. See, Thomas Aquinas, philosophically, thought that the soul should be infused into some type of developed matter, okay? And because of that, he said, well, I don't know if at the moment of conception that it's developed enough. But he said, the church says to me, life begins at conception. So I bend. I bend in faith to what the church says. Even though philosophically, according to my theories, it's quickening. Now, quickening, what does quickening mean? In the past, you know, you didn't know you were pregnant until the kid kicked. Gave you a good shot. Hey. And we said, it's quickening, it's life. But then once you knew the child was there, you don't touch that child. But we know now earlier when the child is there. We don't need to wait for quickening. We need to wait for the scene. But for Thomas Aquinas, if he had today, even philosophically, in front of him, what we now know by modern molecular biology, you remember, was it 2001? We broke the DNA code of life? Huh? What did that mean? It's very interesting, you know, how God works. Every cell in your body has 46 chromosomes. Except in a woman, there's one cell that doesn't. It's the ovum. It's 23. And in a man, every cell has 46 chromosomes, except one cell. It's the sperm. And when the sperm and the ovum fuse, 23 and 23, now you got 46. I see God's design, beautiful. But it's different from mom and dad. It's different from everyone else on the face of the earth. We had the great accomplishment in 2001 that they broke down the DNA code of life. With all the computers and everything else, we did this, eh? And we broke down the code of life, and in this code, in the code of life, okay, we broke the code, we said there's about 60,000 genes in this original cell, the zygote, right? And the genes tell the proteins what to do, and they develop the parts of the body, right? And so in this original cell, you have 60,000 genes in which you are completely programmed there, and the original cell is an irreducible complex organism. We know that now. Check the atom. It's an irreducible complex organism that has incredible information about your whole life from the first moment of conception. See, if you had enough money, you could tell from the first moment of conception whether it's a boy or a girl. You could check that out for you. And we do know from the very first moment of conception if you're going to have heart problems, and maybe at the age of 50, because of genetic deficiency. And this incredible, if you were to print out the information, the chemical information in that original cell, it would take you about 880,000 pages to print out the information in the original cell. And that original cell is different from anyone else in all the world it would ever be. And then we tell the girls, it's a nothing, it's a blood clot. What do you mean? Life begins at the beginning. We know that now more than ever before in history. And if St. Thomas Aquinas had modern molecular biology in front of him, he would say, my God, of course the soul is there from the first moment of its existence, even philosophically. Right? Don't use that quote against me, St. Thomas Aquinas said. Right? Absurd. Right? And so what we have then is this incredible breakthrough. And yet, you know, if you were to have, if you were to look up, so to speak, a genetic dictionary, right, and you saw 60,000 words listed. So when you pick up an average dictionary, you pick it up, and it has words there, and after the words, it has like 11 meetings. It just drives me crazy with the students. I say, do you know what understand this word is? I'll look it up in the dictionary, Father. Right. They go and they take the first entry that's there and they use it. I said, wait a second now. This is crazy. Why are there 11 meanings after the word when you look it up in the dictionary? Why not just one? There's 11 though. Right? And of course what it means is that there's 11 if you use the word a little bit differently. So if it's only one, there's only one meaning. If it's two, three, four, and then in an unabridged dictionary, you'd have the original use of the word in a different manner, Right? So what happens is the student has to figure out which one of these 11 fits best into this context. Right? But there's meanings after the words. But if you were to look up, a genetic dictionary, after the words, there's nothing. Nothing. Because we don't know how they work. It could be another century. Maybe we'll never know. Right? Never know. It's incredible. But we do know what should be there. So, for example, Professor Jérôme Lejeune, father of genetics, in 1959, he discovered that there's 42 chromosomes. Chromosome number 21 in a Down syndrome child, it's repeated. There's two of them. Yeah? Father just died recently. Dr. Epstein, he did further studies on that, and he discovered that the extra chromosome 21 produces an awful lot of proteins that seems to cause the effect on the body of the child. You see, trying to make corrections for it. The chromosomes in the human body, we know what should be there, and so we use it in a negative fashion. You know, why do you mean a negative fashion? Boom goes to in vitro fertilization. Isn't that wonderful, Father? He was an in vitro fertilization child. It's not wonderful. The child is the gift of God, but it's not the way to go. It's a disaster. First of all, there is no child that's given life on a petri dish in the labs that's implanted in the womb of a mother if it fails the test. It's called a pre-implantation genetic diagnostic test. In England, of course, in the United Kingdom, it's the law. In practice, since 1991, American around the world, it's the practice. What do I mean? Well, when the child is conceived in the lab, we don't know how the genes work, but we do know if a gene is missing. So if the child is not genetically perfect, it is destroyed. It's called the screening, the cleansing of the human race. Okay? And so the mother is just like, oh no, it didn't work out, but try again, you see? They try again. So we use the knowledge we have in a negative fashion to eliminate the imperfect. See, when you are born in a family, you didn't have to pass a test. I would have failed. I mean, to continue to exist, imagine that. The kid has to fill out the form. You have to pass the test, otherwise you're finished, kid. That's not the way God intended it. Every kid is a gift of God. No test to be passed. It's an irrepeatable gift that should be loved. How did we get to this situation? When did this happen? Do you know, how many are old enough here to know Pope Paul VI? The man who's got to be canonized some way. Yeah, God, did he suffer. He's a very intelligent man, Carlo Martini. Who's the first pope that came to America? It was Paul VI on October 4th, 1965. Yankee Stadium. But before that, he went and he spoke at the United Nations. And a little bit of background here. In the 50s, Planned Parenthood did the work on what's called, we call today the pill. And they used the women in Puerto Rico as the goats, really. They used the wound in Puerto Rico to perfect it. They didn't care about the side effects. Bleeding, heart attacks, death. That wasn't important. The only thing they were measuring was to what extent it suppresses ovulation. That's all. And when they got it to about 96% suppression of ovulation, they said, we're going to now market it. But in 1959, 1960, it was against the law. You couldn't buy a contraceptive in America. You couldn't buy the pill. It's against the law. Young people don't know that. And as a result, they marketed it as a health to regulate irregular cycles, to regulate irregular menstrual cycles. And so a million women in America had irregular menstrual cycles. And the pill was on the market before it was legal. In June 7th, 1965, there was a nurse working for Planned Parenthood called Griswold. And there was a case that came down to the Supreme Court, Griswold versus Connecticut, 1965, June 7th. It was the first time that married people in the privacy of their home, you see, could buy the pill. But that was the only married people in the privacy of their home, period. Eisenstadt, I guess it was 1970-72, said, well, unmarried adults should be able to buy it. By the end of the 80s, well, unmarried minors should be able to buy it. By the beginning of the 90s, we're giving it out in the schools without parents' permission. See, if you are working at a school, you know you are loco parentis. You're in place of the parents. But you can't do anything without telling the parents. You can't get them an aspirin without informing the parents. Right? You have to call them. You have to let them know. But if I turn the classroom into a health-based clinic, there's a different law between patient and doctor. Between, as opposed to teacher and student. I don't have to call the parents about anything. So I can load up that classroom with condoms and contraceptives and everything else. I can take the child out of the classroom in school and bring them to an abortion clinic and have the child aborted without telling you, a 14-year-old girl. Did you know that? But if some complications follow, you're the parents and you have to pay for the complications because she's a minor. Did you know that? Yeah. So what they did was, by the 90s, they took the classrooms, and in the classrooms, they turned certain classrooms into health-based clinics. And suddenly, what was to be for the privacy of the home for married people was given out to children, minors, in the classrooms. In the classrooms. And then Planned Parenthood said, you give us the classroom, you could have the rest. So who wrote the health curriculum that students must take to graduate? Planned Parenthood. And in there, they teach you all the ways of contracepting, abortion, sterilization, the whole nine. You have to brainwash it. And so suddenly we have social engineering taking place in our schools. Before so what happened is the schools then, by the 90s, actually, without parents' permission, children being given contraceptives, sterilizations, teaching all ways of sexuality and everything else until we get to a situation that it's out of control. In 1965, June 7th, the Griswold versus Connecticut said married people could have the contraceptive. 4 months later, October 4th, 1965, Paul VI came to America to speak to the United Nations. And he gave that famous talk about war never again. He came in a hero. The media treated him like he was a rock star. He was the one who guided everything through the Vatican II. You look at all the documents, they're all signed by him, everything. He was a genius. He's a very intelligent man. Okay, and in Vatican II, if you look at Gaudium et Spes, joy and hope, the decree on the modern world, and there's a magnificent section on marriage, absolutely. And in that section, the church fathers that were present said it's wrong to interfere the act of marriage in itself or the consequences from it. But this pill that Planned Parenthood has developed in Puerto Rico that's being fielded, how about that? And Paul said, well, I'll handle that. Should that be considered wrong to interfere in God's way? Well, it ended up that in 1965, at the United Nations, Paul VI gave this magnificent talk on War Never Again, and they applauded, and he became a hero. By the last third of the talk, suddenly Paul said this, and he knew it. He knew what was going on down. He said, look, you at the United Nations, you most especially must be the last bastion and the first defense of life, as always, as sacred, a gift of God. And you must not deny people to come to the table of life, okay, by contracepting them out of it. You must provide more food so that more people can take part in the banquet of life. By the end of the day, he was under attack. The media turned on him with a vengeance. Okay? He came in a hero and he left a villain. Right? Now, he went back to Rome, and in 1967, he went back and he began to develop another encyclical. It's called Populum Progressio. It's called The Progress of People. And The Progress of People, he said, you must take into account in dealing with people the spiritual dimension of a person. Every person is sacred. Every person must be treated with dignity and respect. Because, you know, sometimes we think that the culture of death started with Roe v. Wade. What was Roe v. Wade? Roe v. Wade was the Supreme Court decision, January 22nd, 1973, legalizing abortion. That was not the beginning of the culture of death. That was the end of the culture of life. It reached the point. And people don't realize. Roe v. Wade, when we legalized abortion, was the end of Western civilization. There was a philosophical battle that took place before that, and we lost. And the philosophical battle was this, and in our founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence said that the gift of life comes from God. Not from any state, not from any person, no one. And any state, any government does not respect life, the gift of life of the person. They have no credibility. They've lost their authority. They've lost their authority. In 1973, January 22nd, it was, I said, the end of Western civilization. Because Western civilization was based on the belief that life was an absolute value that came from God, and there were no exceptions. You can never take an innocent human life. And the quality of one's life, it differs. It differs. One person can do this, another person can do that. The quality of a person's life differs. It's relative, though. But the right to life is absolute. And suddenly, that was turned upside down. The quality of your life was the absolute, and your sacredness of life was relative to the quality of your life as determined by others. And suddenly everything was over. Even in that decision, which was not a judicial decision, it was a legislation, it was an incredible complicated legislative decree from the bench of the judges. They spoke of three trimesters. And in each trimester, as the quality of life differs, you see, your right to life becomes more and more acceptable. But in the first trimester, no right to life. The second trimester, a little bit more. The third trimester, the astronomy, and finally when you're born. So immediately we're talking from the very beginning. There never was a question when life begins. The question is the quality of the life. As judged by others. And now, of course, in the laboratories, that judgment is being made by a small group and not even the parents. And they're screening the human race. And so what happened with that decision, the philosophical battle, that life comes from God, it's an absolute, because there are no exceptions, innocent human life may never be taken, and the quality of life is something which is variable. And so what happened is it was turned upside down. It was turned upside down. And this growth started centuries before. Who was Thomas Malthus? Thomas Malthus. A very important name. Very important name. Thomas Malthus was a British economist, minister, pessimistic person. He was the first one that said the theory that natural resources multiply arithmetically, whereas people multiply geometrically. So people are 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, etc. Whereas natural resources, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So overpopulation is going to destroy the world. We must contain people. We must. Malthusian thinking. Malthusian thinking. Must contain people. And he said, well, nature has its way of doing it with hurricanes, earthquakes, and so forth. And the poor tend not to live too long. We should just let them die. We must not get misled by charity that is going against how nature controls population and maintains the planet Earth. See, we say that's crazy. Oh, no. No. It's the Malthusian thinking that is to this very day, okay, in the highest of places. Highest of places. Charles Darwin. 1859 came out with The Origin of Species. And he had, when he, on the Galapagos, he was speaking and talking about animals and plants and so forth. He had not yet applied it to humans. That things, progress is made by the weak being eliminated. Constant change in which nature tends to get rid of the weak. Herbert Spencer applied it to humans. So you have social Darwinianism. And he said, we must not be misguided by charity, helping the areas, the people, the poor, let them die. The unfit should not be able to breed. Sir Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin, the father of eugenics. Eugenics, not genetics. Genetics is a good science. Eugenics is good birth. He is the one who said, we pass on through heredity most of the qualities that our future generation children have. So people with not good heredity, they should not be allowed to breed. And we should go about and make sure they don't. Eugenics. That type of thinking became very popular. There's a woman called Margaret Sanger. In America, Maria Stopes in England. And they began to buy into this, and we must control birth. There was a different people who then popularized, you know, the population bomb, Ehrlich, but actually it was Hugh Moore. Hugh Moore, the one who ran the Dixie Cup companies, he was a tremendous Malthusian thinking. But John D. Rockefeller III, he really bought into Malthusian thinking. And he created a population council in 1951 of scholars throughout the world to control population. Control population. And then he started to influence our government and the United Nations into, we have to control population. The unfit should not breed. The unfit should not breed. Why do you think Planned Parenthood, without asking, gets $350 to $400 million a year from the government? You ever think about that? You try to get $5. $350 to $400 million without asking. What is this? Well, it's because, you see, the Malthusian thinking in our government, we have made the commitment. We made the commitment now that we do not give aid to countries unless, you know, if we said to the poor countries, if we said this, look, drop dead, they might be suspicious. So you have to do a little bit differently. We have to say, I know you're hungry, I'm going to give you a loaf of bread. But there's a hook on it. The hook is, you can't have children. Memorandum 200 of Kissinger convinced President Ford that for security, our security around the world is to control populations of people who might be our enemies in particular. So no aid is given without the condition that they limit their family. Yeah? And we convinced even the United Nations to do this now. Yeah? And so suddenly you have this whole program of population control, and it done in a way that, look it up. We don't give aid to anybody if they will not take with it the contraceptives, the abortions, the sterilizations. If they will not limit their population, they do not get aid. We flood them. We flood them with it. Okay? And I said, one has the apparatus, the structure around the world is Maria Stopes International and Planned Parenthood International. And so they're used. How many governments not losing in thinking to this day? Okay? That becomes the approach. Recently, a whole group of new politicians went to Washington. That sort of threw them for a loop because they're not the Malthusian thinking people. And suddenly they're defunding Planned Parenthood. What's this? What are you doing? You're crazy? We need Planned Parenthood to get our... See, the whole thing. Yeah? Suddenly. But the point is this, who is your enemy? What is going on down? Well, it ended up that this type of thinking and eugenics became very popular with the people of the highest levels, in which they always thought of themselves as the fit. It was the others who were the unfit that should not breed. The others were the unfit that should not breed. Not them, somebody else. Right? And suddenly you had this tremendous billionaires, millionaires supporting this to this day. To this day, look up the names. Look up the names of the incredible billionaires that are supporting this program, okay, of population control. And it was a type of, and now we can really get on with it. We got the pill. We got the contraceptives. Now we can really eliminate the poor. Yeah? We can eliminate the poor. Paul VI knew this. He knew the background. Okay? He also knew that we reached the point where you had positivistic thinking with coming from a century before, in which we reduced that you really can't, faith should not really influence what public policy. As a matter of fact, in Europe, most of the wars were a result of religious wars. After the Protestant Reformation, it became whoever was ruling that area, it was his faith, his religion. And most of the people left Europe to get away from that. And when they came to America, they didn't want the state to impose upon them a religion. So we said that the government shall not establish a religion. It did not mean that the government should be against religion. God knows. Right? But suddenly, we want to eliminate God and religion. Even now, in the European Union, God is not able to be mentioned, because that's a source of war. Right? Misguided, see? And so what happened is this thinking of the people that you have to eliminate faith, by the end of the 20th century, people are questioning about, because of positivism, are you able to know a truth that we all could agree upon? Is truth universal? Or is it all subjective? And therefore we should eliminate even truth, or the mind. And the only thing you really canonize is what you can arrive at through the senses, experiential knowledge. Yeah. Yeah. And suddenly we have, in our laws, anything that has truth is being eliminated. Because it's having someone be in some other values being imposed on someone else that doesn't accept them. You know, when you want to hand on to your children your values, you have certain customs in your house. This is what we do. You don't like it, you leave, okay? This is what we do. And eventually you get older, you say, my God, my parents are pretty bright. You know, this is what we had to do. I didn't understand why, but it made an awful lot of sense. Right? It made an awful lot of sense. This is what we had to do. One generation does not have to start off, the next generation does not have to start off from nothing to figure out how to live and where wisdom lies. One of the things you do is you want to hand on to your children wisdom. How to live. And I said there's two types of knowledge, productive knowledge and what we call directive knowledge. Most of our universities, productive knowledge, how to make a living. How much will this cost if I take it? Well, how much will I be able to make and pay in the future? Oh, that's the course I want. Directive knowledge is, this doesn't teach you how to make a living, it teaches you how to live. It's called wisdom, without which you eventually destroy yourself. You have the ability to light up a city or to blow up a city. What difference? Whatever you want. It's not a matter of can you do it, it's a matter of may you do it, and if you may do it, then you ought to do it. So freedom is not whatever you want to do, freedom is what you ought to do. Because that's only what you may do, guided by Judaic Christian principles. So suddenly what we have is by the end of the time that Paul VI is about to speak, we have this canonization of the experiential sciences and the rejection of faith and even objective truth by reason. And so where you hand on, what was the greater contribution the Romans made to the world? They said it's clear to us, it's our law. We incorporate in the law our wisdom, our mores, how to live. That's our greatest contribution. And it is. But when you remove from the law all the values, all the mores, you cause chaos, absolute chaos, right? And that's what has happened. In other words, what we do is we get a judge to say, no, that's unconstitutional because somebody's values, and the first thing, we reduce the law to nothing. Chaos. And so it happened that by the time Paul VI was about to speak, the Malthusian thinking, the eugenics, birth control clinics run by Margaret Sanger was precisely to control birth. When Adolf Hitler made a whole country implement the eugenics approach, he was approved and applauded. And he got the ideas from America and from England. There were people from America and England went there. In the early beginning of the 20th century, the American government, we sterilized the unfit, the imbeciles, the whole thing. Look it up in the history books. Look it up. It's a fact. Right? And Adolf Hitler was being praised. Now, he carried to an extreme, it was sort of embarrassing to them. But it did not end it. It did not end it. Right? Planned Parenthood, the birth control clinics changed their name to Planned Parenthood. It should be Planned Barrenhood. Right? That's what they did. But what happened, of course, is the eugenics movement now is now with us stronger than ever. It's in the laboratories. It's scientific cleansing of the human race going on in the fertility clinics and in vitro fertilization, etc. You see, at the present time. What happened is Paul VI, when he was about to speak in the United Nations, he knew all this. And then he wrote the encyclical Populorum Progressio, in which he said this whole concept, you cannot destroy and eliminate people, every person is sacred and special, and any true development must take into account the person and their whole being, body and soul, etc., etc. Now, in 1967 he produced that. In 68, he came out with the Mani Vitae. What was the Mani Vitae? There are three documents by the church with vitae, of life. Eh? Umani vitae, donum vitae, evangelium vitae. Umani vitae was in the 60s because under attack at that time, this culture of death was attacking family and the process of procreation. And Paul VI said, life should come into existence in the context of family. The process of procreation is God's creation, you must respect it. You cannot deliberately shut out life in God and make the purpose of sexuality pleasure, period. You'll destroy yourselves. Technology says, but we can do that for you. We can separate the act of sexuality and love from life, from God. So you don't have to worry. We get so caught into this mentality that the purpose of sex is pleasure, that if a person is pregnant, it's like, my God, you've got cancer. You're kidding. You're pregnant? Oh my God, I'm sorry for you. Amazing. And what happened? We opened the door. When marriage became meaningless. If the purpose of sex is pleasure, then you don't have marriage as a design, a plan of God. And you open the door to homosexuality. You can't argue against homosexuality. On what basis? Impossible. We opened the door to it. Right? Because if the purpose of sex is pleasure and not life and you get shut out, well, what's the problem? Right? But not only that, we opened the door to the greater part. What was the greater part? The greater part was this, that if you can separate the act of love and sexuality from life, now we're going to have life without human love and sexuality. We're going to grow life in the laboratories. And Paul, actually, Cardinal Ratzinger, 1987, February 22nd, he had to deal with this. He came out with another statement of the church saying, don't invite the gift of life. And the gift of life, he said, as Paul VI said to you in 68, July 25th, you cannot deliberately separate the act of love and sexuality from life. I say to you now in 1987, you cannot have the act of life without human love and sexuality. It must be in the context of family. Every life is sacred. Doesn't have to pass a test. It's God's gift to you. Should be cared for. Huh? God approved that document by making Cardinal Ratzinger Pope Benedict XVI. Very clear. And recently he brought that up to by Dignitatis Personis. He took the Dona Vitae and brought it to the present time. And that, by the way, he gave that document to President Obama when he visited him. And Pope Leon Progressio, 40 years anniversary, 2007, the Pope wrote an update, Pope Leon Progressio, Caritatis in Veritate. And he presented that to President Obama when he came to visit him. When President Obama came to visit him, he gave him two documents. He gave him Dignitatis Personis, the updated Dona Vitae, and he gave what is true development for mankind, and what is an inhumane humanism, and this must not be done. And he gave those two documents to me. He said, read it. He did. Yeah. And so Paul VI, when he had to defend family and life in the process, Cardinal Ratzinger had to defend that life should not be grown in the laboratories. Because in the laboratories, we can really get on with the scientific eugenics, massive scientific eugenic cleansing of the human race, which we are doing. Thank you, Adolf Hitler, the master race. And we're going beyond that. Now we're going to do experimentations and create, we'll correct all of God's mistakes. We're going to create, do something better than God ever did. We'll eliminate the unfit. And in 1995, March 25th, John Paul II came out with Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. Why another one? Because John Paul II, if you look at that encyclical, he said what? It's mostly dealing with euthanasia. That encyclical, of course it is. Because he says life is not only under attack before conception, as Paul VI had to defend, in the womb, as Cardinal Ratzinger had to defend, he says, but now life is under attack from the womb to the tomb. The same argumentation that you use that the quality of life is the absolute, and if you lose the quality of life, you lose the right to life, built into that is the death of grandma. Of course it is. It's the death of you. Until someone comes along and says, your quality of life is not up to snuff. Right? And we have grown to accept this. We're killing life. We've grown to accept. We're in an incredible culture of death. It's not just the unborn, my friends. It's a much wider picture here. You see? Much wider picture. This culture of death is so immense. And so it's on the elitist. The elitists say, oh, this is like progress. This is, and they'll say, oh, religion shouldn't get in the way of science. I got news for you. It's not just can you do something. The question is, may you do it and ought you to do it? And that's determined by Judaic Christian ethic principles. And once we stop limiting science or letting science do whatever they want, you see, God help us. God help us. Okay? And so the church has to proclaim the truth, acceptable or not acceptable. The church is a living organization. That's why there's so many documents, Vitae Vitae, of life of life, as the culture of death increased, attacked more. The church has to respond. People don't like it, the church can't say, oh, that's okay, we got to be quiet. We can't speak about these things. Look what it's done to our children. It's rather interesting. In 1968, July 25th, Paul VI said, look, I'm telling you the truth. And if you do not follow what I'm telling you, section 17 in the Mani Vitae, I tell you now what will happen in the future. Everything he said happened. Read it. Sometimes it drives me crazy. Sometimes even priests who don't teach a Mani Vitae, they never read it. Never read it. People who reject it. Christians never read it. It's magnificent. You know, John Paul II did a series of talks from 79 to 84 on what is called the theology of the body. Everybody praises it. Oh, wonderful, wonderful. See? At the end of the talks, John Paul II says, look, I tell you now, I couldn't tell you in the beginning. Because everybody said, how wonderful, my God, what beautiful thing, see? You know, I couldn't tell you in the beginning, but all I have been doing for the past 4 or 5 years on Wednesday audiences, I have been reflecting on a Mani Vitae, the document of human life written by Paul VI. I can tell you now, everything I said is right there, and it is there. It is there. Same Holy Spirit. Same Holy Spirit. And I say to you, look, do not be apologetic for the teachings of the church. Do not simply accept the unacceptable, which is a culture of death. We're living in a society in which people are taken for granted. It's okay to kill. It's okay to create the master race. It's okay to have this screening, this scientific elimination of and control of. No, it's not. It's not. You don't ask for whom the bell tolls, because my friends will be tolling for you and me, eventually. No questions asked, you see? And so the life you save may be your own. Life you save, definitely your children, and your children's children. Okay? So what we are called to be in terms of, what is it to be pro-life? Huh? Well, to be pro-life is to seek the salvation of souls. See, this is very, very important. Sometimes pro-life is when they go outside of an abortion clinic, they are there to save babies, which is a good thing. Okay, I don't mind that. But you're there for much more than that. Let me tell you this: for the media likes to have, and I mention this because it's the only answer. It's the only answer, not just outside the clinic. It's the only answer to overcome this culture. Okay, that you're in. Open up your eyes. The media likes to have two sides, pro-life, anti-life. And what they do is they put us against each other, and they then come. They love this, that they said controversial. But you have to think of yourself as no longer on either side. Think of it this way. The reality is that the whole world was broken. The culture of death started, as John Paul II tells us, in the Garden of Eden. It was demonic in its very basis. It turned against God. I will not serve. And there's only one way you're going to overcome the culture of death, because God told us in the Garden of Eden, I give you the answer. I'm going to reestablish a culture of life. How are you going to do that, Lord? I'm going to send a woman and her son. A woman and her son. And he will crush the head of the serpent. And you try to overcome this culture of death by intellectual arguments, by simply going, you're not going to do it. It requires the grace of God, requires the woman and her son in order to be able to win the victory. Now, the world was broken, and when will the woman and the son come? Well, eventually her name was Mary. And of course, the son is the son of God. And he came. And he came into a world that was absolutely estranged from God, broken, and helpless. You take a dish, you throw it on the ground, it's burnt out. You can't put stuff together. Someone outside has to put it together. That's the condition of all of humanity. All humanity. And right now, that's the condition we are in this culture of death. We're incapable of helping ourselves. But that same God, see, sometimes a woman says to me, "Father, I had an abortion. Could God ever love me again?" I say, "Mom, it's the wrong question. Wrong question. God never stopped loving you. God made you because he loved you. God died for you because he loved you. Mom, God never, ever stops loving any one of us. It's we who turn away from God. God has no enemies. We become enemies of God, but God never becomes an enemy of us. My friend, you're crazy. God loves you. You have to convince God to love you again. You're silly. He never stopped loving you. He's waiting for you to love him. That's what it's about. So this unconditional, everlasting love of God is what the world needs. Right? What the world needs. And this everlasting, unconditional love of God is what a pro-life is supposed to do. You are to bring to the problem, not you. You are to bring to the problem the unconditional, everlasting love of God through you. What do I mean? Well, Christianity is not doing something Jesus did 2,000 years ago. Christianity is the mystery, the risen Christ, who's not even tired. He still wants to do the work of his Father. But he has to do it now, not to his body, his risen body. He has to do it to his mystical body. He needs your permission. And the mystery of Christianity is God lives in you. You are Christ. And in and through you, he wants to save the world. So when you go to an abortion clinic, you are there primarily not for the babies. My God, you know, even if they die, they'll go to God. They never did anything wrong in their life. There's two types, even morally or physically, or they just get physically ill. They never did anything wrong in their life. See? They will go to God. No questions asked. But the people doing this to the babies, there's a moral evil going on down. Those are the ones who need Jesus. They need Christ. They need us. Now, if you touch the heart, see, this culture is so strong that many women go into an abortion clinic. They are convinced with the lie that if you have an abortion, it brings back yesterday and get on your life. It's a lie. And so after they do it, they're totally depressed. They say, "My God." See, it's like the centurion. See, one thief believed in Jesus before he died. But the centurion didn't believe in Jesus until he died and put a sword into his side. Many women today, young women in our society, are absolutely convinced this is the answer. It's okay. This will bring back yesterday. Get on my life, you see? And they get in there, and the first thing that happens to them is, relief. My womb is empty. I can get on my life. And 15 minutes later, my God, my womb is empty. All pain, suffering rushes upon them. Their self-esteem goes through the floor. They feel rotten. Neither God nor man, anyone could or should love them. You see? And if you're there to save babies, you're long since gone. If you're there to save babies, you're there to condemn them. Well, it's you deserve it. But if you're there because you are bringing the unconditional love of Jesus Christ to the world that needs it, you are there when she comes back out. That's why I'm there 5 or 6 hours. I speak to women after the abortions. Because Jesus died for them. Jesus loves them. Jesus went to Calvary for the person who was going to kill him. It was the final commandment Jesus gave to us. He said, "Look, I want you to love your enemies. That's the only thing that's going to change the world. I can't do that. I know you can't. I'm going to give you the gift of the power, the virtue of charity. The charity is not human charity. The charity that I give makes you love your enemies. You can't explain that, you see? But these are the people that when they come back out, they then need Jesus. And we're not there. We're gone. And it's then that they realize, the devil did it. I believed him. You see? I thought everything would be fine, and it isn't. I was exploited. I was taken into the ground. And they don't feel me, man or God, anyone could love them. But if you are gentle and loving them before, and when they come back out, you go to them again. You're bringing them back to Jesus quickly. And they're the ones that need salvation. They need Jesus. And so the world needs Christ. There's a blindness. So I don't even ask sometimes about people theoretically, we argue academically and so forth. I've come to the point I say, I want to know how you live. Because if I'm going against your lifestyle, I'm wasting my time with theological, philosophical, or rational arguments. You need the grace of God to change your life. And when you live the truth, you become open to the truth. You accept the truth. You see the truth. But when you're not, you block it out. You defend it. You rationalize. You try to justify the killing of Jesus. Okay? But when they are at their weakest or most vulnerable, right after the abortion, that's when the lie is clear. That's when Christians should be there with love, making present the unconditional, everlasting love of God. Because that's what Jesus wants. And it's from Calvary then all good things will come. You're not going to change any laws. What's causing the people to be in assemblies to be paid attention to is because of people outside at the killing centers, at Calvary's, right across this country and around the world. Everything good came from Calvary. Think of it. What was the greatest evil that ever took place? The day we killed our God. Mm-hmm. What was the greatest good that ever took place? The day our God was killed. He redeemed the world. This culture of death is incredibly evil. But God's permitting it. He's not up in the heavens saying, oh my God, what's going on? The Father say to the Son, what are they doing down there? Let's bring in the Holy Spirit. Maybe he could clue us, you see? It's not that. If God is permitting this, and he is, it's because he's bringing a greater good from it. He would not permit it otherwise. I see all over the world people really being Christians. Loving their enemies, sacrificing, forgetting themselves, and bringing Jesus to the world. And it's only Jesus that can re-establish a culture of life because of the grace that comes. It's not a matter of just saying, giving the truth. I know the truth, says St. Augustine. I need the grace to live the truth. He knew about the grace of God. He knew about the grace of God. And so you go in prayer, you go in love, you bring Jesus Christ to the world. And so the culture of death then, I say to you, look, it's awful. I just explained to you how bad it is. You weren't convinced before you got here, now you should be more depressed. But I say to you, however, we do have the answer. It's the woman and her son. Okay? And if we really take that serious, there's nothing the world can do to stop it. You see? But you have to be informed, you have to know what you're doing, and you have to have tremendous belief and confidence. The power of the rosary, never underestimate. That's the woman and her son, you see? And you go to Calvary, and you go there in love. If you convince someone beforehand, wonderful. The child is born. If it's after, well, that's what happened with Jesus. It took the death of Jesus before the centurion believed. Right? Remember that. And God's promise, it takes the death of the unborn children often enough, right? Before the mothers come to realization, my God, what have we done? What have we done? It was the child of God. Then they need Jesus. Right? And then the child rejoices, God rejoices. Because they both can see mom again. Right? And you'd be that instrument. So to be pro-life then, I'm going to end because I know you're probably that. Okay. To be pro-life is to be seeking the salvation of souls. If you seek that, you'll save babies. But more than saving babies, more important than that, is bring into the world that's in darkness he who is the light. You see? And being convinced that the error, you have to bring to it the truth. Okay? And where there's hate, you bring love. And where there is darkness, you don't curse the darkness, you just turn on the light. You see? You bring Jesus Christ. And if you bring Jesus Christ, suddenly you are becoming a Christian. And I find that all through the world, there are people, there's no question about it. We look at the church and say, well, what's happened to the church, the scandals and everything else? Yeah, there were scandals. It was always that way. Come on. One out of 12 priests didn't make it. It's so funny. Look at Judas. Hmm? But not that. Look at our record. There was only one out of 12 got to Calvary the first time. The only difference is this, my friends. You see? When you're a coward, nobody quite knows it. So, but when I'm a coward, everybody knows it because I stand out, you see? I'm not there. If you're not there, nobody knows it, see? But there were 11 of the 12 apostles weren't there. But eventually, they all went, you know? They had their own Calvaries. And they all died for Jesus. See? But they would have given their left and their right arm to say later, yeah, I was at the foot of the cross with Mary and John. I was there. You see? Yeah, but God gave him another chance. Right? And people are going to say in the future, where were you when that culture of death was taking place? Did you go to Calvary, to Golgotha? It wasn't far from where you lived. You know, people ask me, like 9/11, where was I at 9/11? Well, to tell you the God's truth, at 11 o'clock at night, I was at the World Trade Centers. And I was there with a woman who was a doctor, Malati. She was a doctor from Romania. And she wanted to see one last time this great accomplishment of man. And the next morning, we were at the abortion mill, which is at the foot of New York Harbor. You could look across and see the Twin Towers. And she was there counseling with me. She was leaving that night to go back to Romania. And suddenly, as you know, the two planes came, two buildings came down, and everything in New York stopped. Everything stopped, except that which was absolutely an emergency, and the killing of babies. I was outside the abortion. They did not stop. They're watching on TV, talking about it, but the killing went on. The killing went on. So I could not stop. I could not leave. I didn't get to midnight. I got to ground zero at midnight. Literally. Got through the 7 checkpoints. I was there. People pulling their bodies out. Had this mask on my face. And you felt so helpless. So helpless. Okay. And I closed my eyes. And I was there with the doctor and a engineer. And I said, let's say the rosary. And we started to say the rosary at ground zero that evening. And as I was saying the rosary, I closed my eyes. And I could see the people in the offices getting ready for work. Getting some cup of coffee, some water, and so forth. And at 9 o'clock in the morning, feel so safe, so secure, and suddenly, their security, their safety, from outside, this obstacle came, this incredible terroristic object of a plane filled with 50,000 gallons of gas, like a bomb exploding. And there's no place to hide, no place to go. God help us, you see. But something happened to me at ground zero. This is God's truth. With my eyes closed, I didn't see the people in the office. I saw a child in a womb. And I saw a child in a womb, so secure, so safe. And suddenly an object coming into the womb from outside. And the child had no place to go, no place to hide. I opened my eyes and I realized, my God, ground zero is ongoing. Ground zero is wherever those are under attack, the innocent, who need rescuers. You don't have to come to New York. Come tomorrow with us. Come tomorrow with us to ground zero here in San Diego and be a true hero. Come for the sake of the mothers, for the sake of the people working there, for the sake of the babies. See? Ground zero is ongoing. And if we do not go tomorrow, for many, there'll be no tomorrow for those who come there tomorrow in the future for them. It's very important. It's very important. And when you go and you stand at ground zero, you stand at Golgotha, you stand at Calvary, the children should not die alone. Sometimes we depict Jesus as hanging on the cross, abandoned by God and man, dying alone. That's not true. We take that Psalm 22, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But read the whole Psalm. It's filled with hope. Hope. He was praying the Psalm 22 as he did through his life. But when Jesus looked down, what did he see? He saw his mother. He saw John. He saw Mary Magdalene. He saw the world. He was surrounded by people praying with him, suffering with him, loving him to the end. And I think of Mary, you know, Mary was a Jewish mother. There's no way she didn't speak to her son. No way. Hey, I got to tell you something, see? What did she say? She knew he was a priest. If anyone knew, she did. In him, heaven and earth were joined together. Divinity and humanity in her son. And she knew this was his finest hours. He was redeeming the world. And if she said anything to him, I'm sure she did. She said, Jesus, you stay right on that cross, and I will stand here in prayer until the end. John tells us she wasn't on the ground screaming and yelling. She stood at the foot of the cross. She stood. Of course, Jesus He spoke to his mother. They said, Mary, you know the Father and the Holy Spirit and I, we want you to be my mother. So we kept you immaculata, no stain from the original sin, from the very beginning. But for more than that, why are you suffering here, not for reparation for your sins, you're sinless. Why are we allowing you to suffer? Because these are the birth pangs, the sufferings. Because we intend you to be the mother not only of me, but of everyone born of Christ, of the whole church. John, behold your mother in Christ. Mary, behold your son. The final gift of God to us was not the Eucharist. It was our Blessed Lady. How long it takes people to find Our Lady, their mother in Christ, you see? Come tomorrow with Mary. She'll bring us to Golgotha, to Calvary. And pray with her, be with her and her son. And the people desperately need Jesus and Mary, and they need you. Who needs you? All the people in this culture does. So don't be upset with them. This is God's permitting it. God has a purpose. God loves them, and he wants to save them, and he wants to do it through you, through me. How blessed we are. Hopefully, we'll be there together tomorrow. God bless you.